יאלו לב טוב, עין טובה, מחשבה טובה והרבה הרבה שמחה. הרבה 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 שמחה. התכוננת על מקומו ועוד מעט ואין רשע.
All right, folks, you are listening to The Shai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from my car. That's right, my house is Pesach ready. I just came back from exercise class and about to go back inside, but I know there's more work to do, as usual, as you're getting ready for Passover, for Pesach. So I'm just sitting in my car for a few minutes and recording a little bit of my show for you, wherever you are, and God bless you. Okay, what's going on in Israel? Not much. We're about to enter Rafiah and have a war there. There was also an Iranian attack with 300-400 missiles, projectiles, and drones. They were shot down. Then Israel struck back in Iran proper, not one of its proxies. So we have like an open war with Iran. And then the president of the United States kicks in with sanctioning an Israeli army unit. Ta-da! Nice. Real nice. He wants to sanction the religious Zionist unit, the Netzach Yehuda unit. And the Haredi, it's also the Haredi unit. But basically, it's the religious, the Torah and fighting unit together. Wants to strike at that. By the way, the name of the unit is Netzach Yehuda, the Eternity of Judah. I guess he wants to strike at the Eternity of Judah. Ta-da! and of course, Hezbollah is striking and, in fact, injured some people. And we have the Palestinian Authority. And there was a booby-trapped flag that was put on the side of the road, and a guy came to kick it down, and it blew up. So we got war on all fronts. Not to mention, holy moly, what's going on in Colombia over there. And you got some serious fighting, protests of pro-Palestinians and Israel hate. So not much, you know, and we got Passover, right? We got Passover, and we got to take out the chametz, which means the leavened stuff. But chametz is a lot like Hamas. You got to clean out the Hamas from your land. That simple. It's really so simple. You got to get rid of the chametz. Is that so tricky? Get rid of the chametz. Just get rid of it. Just take it out. That's what we got to do. We got to get rid of that crud. The crud slows you down. It slows you down. So that's the situation in beloved Israel. And yet so funny, because Israel has got this weird reality where things are crazy, and yet they feel normal. Like Pesach is Pesach, and we're looking forward to going to Hebron, and we're looking forward to go to the Eitam Hill here in Gush Etzion, and we're looking forward maybe a beach day. And the house is clean, and there's matzah and seder. B'chol dor v'dor, every generation, they get up to try to strike against us. So that's basically a rundown of what's going on. It's funny, right? It's funny, it's crazy, it's wild, it's dangerous. And I had a reporter from a British station speak to me the other day, came here to Gush Etzion to interview me. And her name is Lucy Watson from ITV News. And she interviewed me about the situation. And she was just like, you know, it's really bad. You know, is this, what do you think about this time? And I'm like, it's one of the greatest times in Jewish history through the thick and thin here. So here's my interview with her, which I recorded. This is my recording of my interview with her. You won't see all this on their channel. I don't even know if they put out. Every time they interview me, they don't put it out at the end. They're always looking for me to like be tripped up and say something stupid. And I guess I just don't provide them with the material that they want, because they never like, they take the time to bring their camera crews and bring it out and have a discussion, a serious discussion, and they're taping and the whole thing, you know, and we organize for them to come, but then they never play these things. I think they're looking for me to say something, you know, horrible, but I just don't. Anyway, you judge for yourself. Here's my discussion with Lucy Watson of ITV News.
Can you just give me your reaction to the response last night?
I guess we don't really know exactly what levels of attacks of back and forths between Iran and Israel, what the level is. But I think we could all understand that the big change is that what has been a shadow war for years is now out of the shadows and in the front. And so if you see some of Khomeini's tweets, you could see what he's calling for, the destruction of Israel in toto. And that's the war that we have with them. And so it's no longer just their teammates in Gaza and in the South Lebanon and in Yemen, their proxies. Now it's them. Now it's the Iranian regime, as opposed to the Iranian people. In distinction from the Iranian people, who many of them, including on social media, you could see, are really pro-Israel, anti-Iranian regime. In any case, the regime is now fully against us. They think this is their moment. And of course, we're going to disappoint them.
Was it the right response?
It's hard for me to judge. I think that Israel should be a bigger player in this region, security-wise. I think that we could really help create a region that has stability. If we would patrol the Red Sea and all the way to the Persian Gulf and have teammates like the UAE, like India, I think that Israel could be a regional power that really brings stability to this whole area, pushes back on jihadism, which is the scourge of the Arab world and the Muslim world, and allows people to thrive around here. We could have unbelievable tourism. We can have unbelievable regional cooperation and economy. But it's stymied by the hate, by the machines of hate. And so I would like to see Israel be a bigger power that stymies that hate.
To be a bigger power, then, were you expecting a bigger reaction?
It's hard for me to react specifically to the tits and tats of this conflict right now. We were attacked on October the 7th by an Iranian proxy, Hamas. Hezbollah is ready to attack us with their armament, with their barrage of missiles. And so we have a situation where Israel is under threat. We got to push back. What the level of the response is, it's hard to say. I would love to see, and we all would like to see, and millions of people would like to see regime change in Iran, and that would change the picture of this region. Is Israel going to fight for that? I don't know. But I can tell you that millions of peoples in this region would like to see the end of those purveyors of hate that are in Tehran and really destabilize the whole region.
What do you think you need to do to get rid of that hate then?
You know, when Iranian people stand up and walk in the streets and demonstrate against the regime, they get cut down, they get tortured, they get shut down. So this is a regime that's a hater. And then I think I heard that Foreign Minister Lavrov from Russia is saying that Iran is the victim here, and that they don't have any nuclear interests or nuclear bombs. That's a cover. We all know that they do. They say it themselves. And then I heard that the minister also said that Israel is the one that's causing extremism because it doesn't sue for a Palestinian state on this land. I mean, a Palestinian state would just be another Iranian outpost. And so you have elements in this world that are suing for destabilization. Sadly, like Foreign Minister Lavrov's words. And the Iranian regime. And then you have forces like the UAE, like Israel, like India, that want to push back on jihadism and establish a more calm and fertile ground for commerce, for industry, for tourism. And that's Israel. And I think that Israel needs to be a bigger player in terms of security in this region. I think that's the future.
Are you concerned that, I mean, it has been described as a small, limited response? Are you concerned that it wasn't perhaps enough to deter Iran further?
I can understand statesmen who think to themselves, let's not get this escalated. I can understand where they're coming from. They don't want a total escalation here. I can understand that. People are afraid of a bigger war and a nuclear war, God forbid, and all these things. So there's, they want to hold fast. They don't want it to escalate, and that's understandable. The problem is that it's going to escalate one day or another. It will come. There's no doubt that it shall arrive at some point. Why? Because that is the stated goal of the Iranian regime, to destroy Israel. They said it. He said it in a recent tweet. He said, you know, Jerusalem is going to be Muslim, Palestine is going to be liberated. But he really means the destruction of Israel in toto. That's what he means. So, you know, unless those guys retire, which I don't see them retiring anytime soon, because they're making millions of dollars off of it, billions of dollars off of it. So there's going to be a day, there's going to be a reckoning. It seems like that reckoning is coming closer right now. The region is heated up. Do I understand the people who don't want that? I can understand that. I can understand how people, how Israeli leaders.
Are you not one of those people?
I would like to see a new leaf where jihadism doesn't threaten Israel. Right now, we have on our borders in Gaza, we've got these tunnels full of armament and readiness to attack Israel. In South Lebanon, we have 150,000 rockets trained at us, and these people are being funded and ideologically funded as well by the Iranian regime. It would be nice to see them no longer threatening us. When my country's threatened, I don't like to see that. And I don't want to roll that over to my children. Okay. I don't want to roll the kick the can down the road. So there should be a reckoning. We must deal with these folks, not to mention the millions of Iranians that are enslaved by this Iranian regime.
Does the concept of a reckoning not alarm you?
I mean, I'm much more alarmed by the potential missile barrage that might rain down on me or on my country or on my children in 10 years, in 15 years, in 20 years.
But this has the potential to involve the entire region, potentially beyond that.
Look, you have to be realistic about who your enemy is. I take the position of respect to my enemies. I think they're serious. I think they mean business. And, you know, as I hear your British accent, I am reminded by the, you know, great tension between Chamberlain and Churchill. There are these moments in time where appeasement at the end does not work. And sometimes, like Churchill said, it's like, you know, when will the lesson be learned? And so am I concerned about it? You're damn right I'm concerned about it. I'm not taking it blithely. I'm not saying, you know, it's like, yeehaw, let's go to war. But at the same time, you have to have a seriousness and a respect for your enemy and understand that they mean business and they cannot and will not be appeased. They want war at the end. They don't want war. They want to destroy Israel. And we want to preempt that. We want to make sure that doesn't happen.
Do you want war then?
No, we want safety. And as I've said throughout this interview, we want this region to thrive, including Iranian people. And we've already started that. I mean, you know, one way to understand the whole October 7th is that this was an Iranian strike against a recognition of Israel by Saudi Arabia. So this whole thing was pushed forward because they realized that Israel's becoming a normal part of this region, the Abraham Accords under President Trump. And so here they have a different American president, and they realize that here's the opportunity to stop Israel's success with the Arabs in this region. They want to make sure that the Muslims don't accept Israel. So the way that they did it is that they foisted this war upon us. And now we had to, of course, strike back, kill a lot of mostly militants, but some civilians as well. Then they want to portray that as Israeli genocide and aggression. By the way, Lavrov also used that horrific canard and blood libel that Israel's committing a genocide. And thereby get the Arab world and the Muslim world to hate Israel again and push away from where it was going, which is towards recognition and normalization. So we can't let them win. We got to push back towards normalization of Israel in this region, cooperation with the Arabs, with the UAE, with Saudi Arabia, with North Africa, with Morocco, etc. And that's the way forward. So we got to push back those forces of destabilization. That's what they want to do. They want to destabilize. They have a perfectly legitimate reason. They hate Israel. They want jihadism. They recognize that Israel is the opposite of Iran. It's creative. It's a force of light in this region, of progress, of human rights, of decencies, of opportunities for men, women, etc. So they don't want that. And so they realize that Israel is a force of a, I'll use a word that has become dirty, of liberalism, of, and I mean that in the sense of liberties.
Now, you used to work as an advisor to Ben-Gvir.
Minister Ben-Gvir.
Minister Ben-Gvir, sorry. He's posted a tweet today, his response to the strike last night. And forgive my Hebrew, but it translates pretty much as disappointing or pathetic. He was disappointed in the level of the strike last night. What do you think? Is that appropriate?
He's a minister in the government. He represents a large swath of people. He's saying what many of us think, which is, okay, if you're going to do this thing, let's not start a little Cold War, a little tit for tat. You strike this, I strike that. Let's not go into that kind of mode. Let's go in the mode of victory. Let's take down the bad guys. Let's not let them have any way to think to themselves, Israel's a pushover. They have to understand that we mean business. So he represents a swath of Israelis. And I guess also, if you follow social media, tons of Iranians as well. And people in the region who want to see Israel push back on this jihadist danger.
Does he represent you as well?
I think he represents us in this town, not only him, but all the nationalist parties. But I definitely think that Minister Ben-Gvir has been one of the leaders that has said Israel has to rearm itself. Civilians have to be armed. Prisoners, jihadist terrorist prisoners, should not be treated overly sympathetically. He does represent a impulse of a strong Israel. And one of the ways that you know that he represents that is that the people that want to see Israel shrunken and weak hate him because they don't like what he represents, which is an ideology of, okay, you know, let's not kid ourselves. These guys want our death. That's what October 7th represents. The October 7th brought a lot more people into the camp of people like Ben-Gvir.
So ultimately, Ben-Gvir, yourself, people living in this town, don't think that was a hard enough reaction.
It's very hard to second guess leaders that really see the picture. I don't even know exactly what Israel struck. It's still shrouded in mystery. I'm glad that Israel struck back. But I just don't want to see it as like this kind of like a ping pong game. I want it to be serious so that we have deterrence against enemies that are serious about trying to destroy us. I mean, it might be a little hard for you to visualize that. And I respect that. You come from a different place, and maybe historical memory has waned. But when you have an enemy, and we Jewish people are schooled very well in what it means when enemies claim that they want to destroy us, they mean business. So it's hard for you maybe to put yourself in our shoes, but we don't want to be destroyed, and we don't want to see those powers, that want our destruction, strengthened. So people like Ben-Gvir is calling out what a lot of people think, which is we gotta make sure that doesn't happen again. We gotta defend ourselves. And again, I think that's actually for the stabilization and peace of this whole region. The real destabilizing force, look at Lebanon. Who's the destabilizing force in Lebanon? Hezbollah, right? They've destroyed that society, that country, that beautiful country. They've destroyed it. Who's their funder? Iran. Who's their ideological funder? Iran. Look at Gaza. One of the most beautiful pieces of land in the world. The very name Gaza has become a negative meaning. But it's one of the most beautiful beaches, historic beaches in the world.
It's been totally obliterated.
It has. It has. And who's at fault for that? Hamas, that launches attacks from that area. He's used it as a forward base for jihadism. Of course, really who's at fault is Israel for ever having given away that piece of land to the PA, the Palestinian Authority, which of course became the Hamas. We were staunchly against that. We said, don't give away this land.
Where does this end, Ishai?
First thing, there's two ways I need to answer that, okay? One way is the way I answer my enemies, which is, if need be, we can continue this war for 1,000 years. We are not afraid of being armed. We are not afraid of being a military type of society. If need be, to fight off our enemies. Nobody should think that peace is so important that we're willing to just be destroyed for the sake of peace. We're not willing to commit suicide for peace. We're not willing to leave our land and to forget about our rights for peace. No. So that's one answer. On the other hand, there's a beautiful answer, which is the train that started going under the Trump administration, which is the train of the Abraham Accords, has a future. Has a future. I speak to Arabs all the time. I speak with Muslims all the time. I speak with every kind of non-Jew that lives in this country. If it's Druze, Cherkessi, Bedouin, Christian Arabs, Muslim Arabs, that tell me all the time, you guys have to be strong against the jihad. You guys have to be, you have to push back on it. They will destroy you. They will destroy us. I remember in Gaza, the Gazan Arabs said, don't leave. They would say to me, don't leave. You don't understand who's going to take over. So the second answer to your question is, where does it all go? It goes towards regional realignment with Israel strong pushing back on the jihadism. But then Saudi Arabia and other countries recognizing that we are cousins in this region. We have to stop fighting with one another. We all want to serve God. We care about history. We are cousins. We're the children of Abraham. There's a regional opportunity that could come about if we don't succumb to the whims of Qatar, of Iran, and the jihadist ideology.
How do you feel overall about the times that you're living in?
So I'll give you two answers again. It's very Jewish of me. I'm giving you the two answers. Okay, I can't give you one straight answer.
Is that balance?
Yeah. The deep answer is that we're living in the greatest time in Jewish history in 2,000 years. Okay, that's the truth. We actually are super excited about the time that we're living in.
Really?
This is the greatest time in the Jewish story in 2,000 years. And you look around this town, we are back in our homeland.
Why is this the greatest time?
Because
thousands of people are dying.
Yeah, but they were dying before we were back in our land also. World wars are not, that's not, we don't make, world wars, and the Jewish people are just defending themselves in these world wars, in these various world wars. There's a humongous power struggle here, but we're in a sense caught in the middle because there's, Iran, Qatar, they are jihadists. They want to destroy the West. The West wants to, we're as usual caught in the middle here. Okay. But what we're doing is that we're coming back to our ancestral homeland. To us, that is the greatest gift, a promise, a biblical promise, a historic promise. We're repatriating our land. If you ask any, American Indian, could you go back to your homeland? They say, yeah, please, if we could just go back to our homeland. We're going back to our homeland. We're an ancestral tribe from this land. We're back in our land, speaking our language, speaking the Hebrew language. Our country's strong. It's got a good economy. It's got a good military. And we're religiously minded. We're historically minded. We're about to have the, Passover holiday and as the way we've done it for thousands of years. But now we're doing it back in our land. This is where we're organic. This is a big deal for us. Okay. And God bless those that live in Brooklyn or live in London, or live in any of those places. But to live in Judea, to speak our language, it's a totally different level of connection to God, connection to history. When we raise our children, you should see the incredibly holistic sense that they have. They're speaking the language of the Bible. They're living in the land of the Bible. They're fulfilling the commandments of the Bible. And they're doing it in fun. And yes, there is self-sacrifice involved in that also. Self-sacrifice is part of the Jewish story. That's part of our DNA. That's just the deal. That's just the deal. So it's an incredible time. So that's one answer. But the other answer is that since our country has been doing stupid things, like giving away land to our enemies, things have become degraded in terms of security. And so, ever since the Sinai so-called peace deal with Egypt, that we gave away the land, the Sinai, to Egypt, which, of course, the Sinai was never Egyptian beforehand. It's a kind of invention. It was not Sinai was always a separate part from Egypt. But we did that, and then we gave the world the idea that we were willing to give land for peace. And then they took over more land, and we left South Lebanon, and we left Gaza. And then when you speak to any Arab, they'll tell you, you guys are shrinking. You guys will not be here in the future. Any Arab will tell you that. They'll say, yeah, you guys are, you guys are, even the ones that are for us will tell us, what are you doing? You're giving away your land. You're shrinking. You're giving a signal to the jihad that that they can defeat you over time. And so, therefore, we're also living in a great time, but we're also living in a time of mistakes that are costly and cost lives. And so, therefore, in that sense, it's a time to roll back the policies of the two-state solution, and to be strong in your land. Remember, though, very important to remember, Israel is a minuscule part of the Middle East. Yeah, you got it.
Yeah.
You may put your sunglasses back on.
Oh, thank you.
Me too, thanks.
Okay, I hope that was a little bit helpful.
I get back to your scrubbing.
All right, fabulous. Thank you so much for being with me. That was Lucy Watson of ITV News interviewing me. Very interesting stuff. Let me know what you think by writing me an email, yishai@yishaifleischer.com. Friends, I got a chance to bake the matzah. I got a chance to bake the matzah and be part of a whole matzah bakery thing. And that matzah baking is one of the most exciting things that we do all year, and my kids join in as well. It's very, very special. And my great-grandparents were the matzah bakers, bread and matzah bakers in a Polish town. And it's very special kind of to be part of that. And one thing I can tell you about the matzahs is that it's a long process from the beginning of the mixture to the shaping of it, to the making holes, and finally to the oven part, which is where I work. And what's sad is that about 80% of the matzahs make it, but 20% like don't. They either burn or fall, and somehow they just don't make it for various reasons. And when you look into that oven, that like pizza-style oven, when you look into it and you're working with it, you really see the Holocaust. You realize how many Jews didn't make it. You remember all the pain. It just speaks to you. And then what's amazing is that with all of the beloved matzahs and people that fall, the nation goes through. The nation continues to survive. That is the Jewish destinies, to continue to survive throughout generations and challenges. And yes, there are falls. And sometimes even the best righteous people and the best righteous matzahs don't make it for some reason. And that God only knows why. God only knows why. And I mean to say God only knows why. I don't mean to say like God only knows. I mean like God only knows. He's the only one who knows. But the nation keeps surviving and thriving. And that's the time that we're living in. Here's an amazing story brought to you by our beloved Ben Bresky about a blood libel in Europe, maybe the last blood libel in Europe, the story of Mendel Bayless. Our intrepid reporter Ben Bresky brings us this story and the story of redemption through that blood libel and to the land of Israel. Ben Bresky, take it away.
This is a moment in Jewish history. Mendel Bayless was falsely accused of murdering a child, and his trial in 1913 was big news in Russia and throughout the world. It was considered the last of the blood libels, and when he was finally exonerated, he moved to the land of Israel. Because Mendel Bayless withstood the pressure in a Russian prison for 2 years, refusing to falsely admit guilt or point the finger at any of his fellow Jews, he was considered a hero. Upon his arrival in Israel, which took place close to Passover, he was greeted by shouts of "Long live Bayless!" and met with leaders of the community, including Rabbi Avraham Yitzhak Cook, the first chief rabbi of the land of Israel. Students came to greet him with flags and flowers and a band. That all happened after his dramatic trial. First, some background information. Mendel Bayless was born in 1874 to a Hasidic family, but as he grew up, he became secular and often worked on Shabbat if necessary. He served in the army of the Russian Empire, got married, had 5 children, and worked at a brick factory near Kiev. Bayless worked long hours and had good relations with both Jewish and non-Jewish communities. He received special permission to leave the Pale of Settlement in order to work at an office in the brick factory near the all-Christian village, where he was well-liked by his co-workers. On March 20, 1911, 12-year-old Andrei Yushkinsky was murdered, and his body was found near the factory. A criminal gang, led by a woman named Vera Chibiriak, had been known in the village for some time. They committed thefts and intimidation. Young Andrei had the misfortune of stumbling upon them and overheard part of their conversation. The generally accepted truth is that it was she and her henchmen that did away with Andrei to silence him. The misfortune of Mendel Bayliss is that he was a Jewish man who just happened to be working in the same area on the same day. But Mendel Bayliss was not just accused of murder. He was accused of being part of a secret Jewish conspiracy to kill Christian children and use their blood to make Passover matzah. The false accusation had been around since the Middle Ages. I recall a comic strip by Jewish writer and artist Jordan Gorfinkel, in which he jokingly said that if blood were in fact used in matzah, then why isn't it pink? But all jokes aside, the blood libel has plagued Jewish communities for generations. Pope Gregory X issued the Papal Protection of the Jews in 1272. In it, he states that sometimes unscrupulous Christians would falsely accuse Jews for monetary gain. He states that anyone who knows anything about Judaism knows it is against the Jewish religion to consume blood or non-kosher animals of any kind, let alone commit murder. But the Pope's call for understanding was not always heeded, especially not in the Russian Empire, keen on finding a scapegoat, especially for their flailing empire. The Russian authorities sent prosecutors to make sure that Bayliss was deemed guilty. Vera Chibiriak and members of her gang were initially arrested, but several days later, Bayliss got a knock on his door. He writes in his autobiography that the arrest surprised him, and went as follows. "You are a Jew, are you not? Where do you pray? Is there a synagogue here? I am a Jew. There is no synagogue here, but one can pray at home. Do you observe the Sabbath? The factory is kept running on Saturdays, so I cannot leave the place." That was just the beginning. Although Bayliss was respectful of his Jewish heritage and kept some traditions, he was a typical secular Russian Jew. Nevertheless, the authorities continued to try and pin on him some elaborate secret scheme. They asked, "Are you a Hasid or a Misnagid?" "I am a Jew," I answered, "and I have no idea of the distinction between Hasid and Misnagid." "What do you Jews call an Afikomen?" "To these, I have but the same answer," Bayliss continued. "I began to regard these men as somewhat unbalanced. What could they possibly want? What had Yudzinski's murder have to do with the Afikomen? And furthermore, how did the difference between Hasidim and Misnagim concern them? I could only imagine that they were poking fun at me, but unfortunately, it was no matter of jest." In their hearts, perhaps there was a deep conviction that Vera had murdered the boy. Perhaps these questions were directed at me under orders from the powers above. Indeed, the orders did come from the Russian higher-ups. Bayliss spent 2 years in prison. His trial finally came in 1913 and drew international attention. Famous writers and scientists from around the world decried his arrest, including H.G. Wells, Arthur Conan Doyle, Booker T. Washington, and the Archbishop of Canterbury. Bayliss had a top attorney who felt that he was not just defending an individual, but the entire Jewish people. Against Bayliss was a group called the Black Hundreds, who supported the Russian monarchy. At the trial, experts were brought in. Both Jewish and Christian witnesses testified that Bayliss was innocent. Witnesses for the prosecution fell in Bayliss's favor as well. One was the lamplighter, whom the Black Hundreds were sure would prove that Bayliss had committed the murder, but he said he had been plied with vodka, and he knew nothing of the night in question. Another witness, an old beggar woman in rags, caused laughter in the courtroom when she angrily told the judge to leave her alone. The night of the murder, she spent sleeping in the market where she collected charity, and the little money she got, she used on alcohol to drown her sorrows. The experts brought in by the prosecution to try and attack the Jewish religion were revealed to be ignorant and easily disproved in court. The jury was made up of simple, hardworking, religious Russian peasants. After over 30 days of testimony, it was finally time for the verdict. The jury unanimously declared him not guilty. There was open weeping of joy in the courtroom. Bayliss became a hero not only to the Jewish community, but to the average Russian impressed with his dignity under pressure. And when it was all said and done, Bayliss and his family moved to Israel, where he had celebrity status. Bayliss wrote, For quite some time, I would wander around, inspecting every corner of the country, breathing the refreshing air. At first, I could not sleep at night. I felt as though I did not want to lose a moment of the fragrant, inspiring nights in Palestine. The first Saturday in the land, Rabbi Cook invited me to attend his synagogue, where he held a two-hour discourse about me. It was almost Passover, and innumerable tourists were arriving in Palestine for the holiday. Almost every ship brought 700 or 800 people, all of whom wanted to meet and greet me, to shake my hand, and express their sympathy. These in addition to the native Palestinians. At last, I decided to visit Jerusalem. Within no time, the news had spread throughout the town, and endless receptions began. In 3 days that I spent in Jerusalem, I had to visit all the synagogues, inspect the hospitals and charity institutions. But the greatest point of interest for me was the Wailing Wall and the site of the ancient temple. The Jews throughout the world prayed for a happy outcome of my fate during the whole time of my imprisonment until the day of my liberation. My misfortune was the misfortune of the whole Jewish people. But there was something closer to me in the fact that Jews had prayed at the Wailing Wall there, where Jews have wept and prayed for almost 2,000 years, bemoaning the great national loss, the supreme tragedy of the Jewish people, their bitter exile. My trial was but an episode in the history of our life in the diaspora, but it was a part in the record of our national sorrows. Surely the praying for me at the Wailing Wall was most appropriate. It was with mixed feelings that I came close to the old wall, to the silent witness of the ancient Jewish glory and the present in glory. As I was standing at the wall, absorbed in thought, I heard a sudden cry. Turning, I saw H. Berlin, one of the members of my party, crying. It was surprising from a man who had no Jewish characteristics whatsoever. He had been supposed to be far removed from Judaism altogether. His daughter, a doctor who could not even speak any Yiddish, was crying. Berlin later explained to me that he had cried both from sadness and joy. I reminded myself of our exile, but also thought of the new hope for a Jewish homeland, he said. On the site of the ancient temple, as everyone knows, there now stands a Mohammedan mosque. Pious Jews go nowhere near it, and the Mohammedans permit no unbelievers to enter it. In my case, however, an exception was made. We will permit you to enter the mosque, I was told by one of the leading Arabs. You belong to the three great Jewish heroes and martyrs. One of the others he mentioned was Dreyfus. I was given a guide to take me through the place and was shown all the curiosities. I saw the place where Solomon was supposed to keep his horses and the rostrum from which he addressed the people. From Jerusalem, I returned to Tel Aviv and began the process of becoming a resident gradually. As time went on, I became more attached to Palestine. The climate was doing me good. It healed my physical and spiritual wounds. In a short time, I felt as though I were a native of the country, as though I had been born there and lived there all my life. In Tel Aviv, for the first time, I began to appreciate what the true Jewish life is. I saw for the first time a race of proud, uncringing Jews who lived life openly and unafraid. So wrote Mendel Bayliss in his autobiography. Unfortunately, he and his family did not stay in the land of Israel. World War I changed everything. Bayliss, like most other residents, struggled to make ends meet. He resisted leaving the land he loved for as long as possible until 1921, when things were so bad he and his family left for the United States. Bayliss spent the rest of his years in Bronx, New York. In an interview from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency from 1933, he stated that he was offered large sums from Hollywood movie deals and to appear on stage, but he turned it down. Quote, "These offers involved my exploiting myself as a Jew and as a Jewish victim of a cruel and unjust persecution, so I refuse and would still refuse today. I went to Palestine hoping to find peace there, but the war intervened. I lost whatever little money I had. My oldest son died there, and I found it impossible to make a living. But even here, the shadow of the trial hangs over my head. It seems as if I will never get rid of it. I did not ask to be chosen as a victim, a korban, to stand up for the entire Jewish race. I was happy where I was. I had my work, my family, my friends. Suddenly, I was taken away from this and became a symbol for the entire Jewish people. But since fate had chosen me, I went through the ordeal. I suffered and my family suffered. The Russian Gentiles, who sacrificed themselves for me, there was real heroism. They knew that by defending me, their careers would be ruined. Even their very lives would not be safe. But they persisted because they knew I was innocent. But I lived to see the rotten Tsarist regime crumble. I lived to tell the whole story. And that is a miracle. When Mendel Baylis died in 1934, over 3,000 people crowded in the streets at his funeral. Rabbi Idol Idelson of Eldridge Street Synagogue stated at the funeral, "His name is holy to Jews throughout the world." With tears streaming down his face, he pointed to the weeping family. "Don't think that only the family has lost a dear one. The Jewish people have lost a great man." His grandson, Jay Baylis, stated in the Jerusalem Post at the 100th anniversary of the trial the following, "Often I'm asked what it means to be the grandson of Mendel Baylis, and that's a very easy question to answer. At a very young age, some 50 years ago, adults would come up to my father and many times openly weep at his feet. I believe that my grandfather's trial was a warning to many Jews. Perhaps we even have survivors among the people in this very room that were able to leave some of those countries, saving them from the Shoah." Jay Baylis went on to re-edit his grandfather's autobiography with new translations and notes, retitled Blood Libel, The Life and Memory of Mendel Baylis. This has been a moment in Jewish history. Thank you to Yishai Fleischer. Thank you to all the listeners, many of whom have come up to me personally and sent me emails telling me how much they enjoy the podcast. These words encourage me to continue. Thank you for listening. And shalom.
All right, and we're back here on the Yishai Fleischer Show. This is a short show today, but I wanted to really bless you and wish you all the very best. And to remind you that the holiday, the festival holiday of Passover, Pesach, is akin to Abraham. And this is the beginning of the year. It's the beginning of time. God frees us from all the fat and the leavened and the grease and the stuff that holds us down, the stuff of death, and gives us rebirth into the stuff of life. He lightens us. He restarts us. That's what Passover is about. It's about a promise to Abraham. It's about the covenant to Abraham. It's about circumcision. It's about blood. And it's about servitude to God. And it's about purpose. And it's about trajectory. That's what it's about. And I want to wish you a great trajectory in life. Continue to feel that you're serving God and you're getting close to God and you're here to connect to God. And he's speaking to us. And he's speaking to us also through the God of history and the name of history. I want to thank all the folks that make the show possible. Yocheved Seidman, Moshe Herman, Ben Bresky, Tabitha, and Lou when we're live. I want to thank our sponsors, which are awesome, including prohibitionpickle.co.il for deliciousness and spiritual food, soul food from the Jewish perspective. That's prohibitionpickle.co.il. Our good friends at retrowatchguy.com making awesome watches. Retro watches come back to life. That's the Jewish people. The time is now, but it's from those days. That's retrowatchguy.com. Check them out. Our good friends at Kosher Cycle Tours, touring you in the land of Israel and around the world in kosher awesomeness, koshercycletours.com, and our good friends at hebronfund.org, protecting the forefathers and mothers that are buried in Hebron. That's where I work, and I have the greatest honor to do that. And our friends on the Mount, High on the Har, highonthehar.com, taking you to Yerushalayim. If you're here for Passover, please avail yourself of coming to Hebron and coming to the Tomb of the Patriarchs and Matriarchs, and coming to the Temple Mount. Please do not miss that opportunity. All right, I want to thank all of you for being out there. I want to wish you an awesome rebirth. And let's just get through this incredibly hard time. But you realize that all the haters, all their efforts are for naught. Because I'm Yisrael Chai. and we will be victorious because we are connected to Hashem and we are back in our land. And this is the most amazing time. And all these purveyors of hate and fear shall not win. We shall be victorious because we've got a destiny. And that destiny is Hashem's dream. It's His vision for this world. And He's going to fulfill it. And nothing can stop that vision. There's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come. There's nothing more powerful than a prophecy and God's vision whose time has come. God bless you, folks, wherever you are. Stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected, and shalom.